Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
The first time I witnessed mindfulness meditation was in a cowshed in West Clare. I'd heard of the practice of being in the moment, and I'd even read some of the teachings of Jon Kabat-Zinn and Thich Nhat Hanh, but still I struggled with the concept. Then, one very wet evening by the estuary, where the Atlantic Ocean and the Shannon and Fergus rivers begin to socialize, the idea of being in the moment was explained. Outside the cowshed, I squelched and dripped, moving like a robot in restricting rain gear, trying to make myself useful, as humans sometimes need to do, even in the most ludicrous conditions. Inside the shed stood four donkeys, gazing softly, as mindfulness practice would suggest, out the door. Because they weren't looking at me, I joined them in the shed. My need not so much to be present as to be in their presence. The donkeys ignored my soaking wet intrusion, deep in the stillness of their meditation. I stood amongst them seeking attention. When none was offered, I lay an arm over the animal to either side of me. The rise and fall of their bodies was grace-filled, gentle. They looked out at the teeming rain as it cross-stitched into the estuary waters, a basket of great thread above, below, and beyond. The rhythm of the rain on the corrugated roof was ornamented by the gush from the gullies and the eaves. If they saw what I saw, they didn't react, but seemed to accept each moment, each raindrop, without judgment, watching it dissolve as the coming moment replaced it. Elvis, the tall grey jack donkey, was on my right. Because of his wicked sense of humor, I was surprised by his ability to stay so still for so long. His partner, Priscilla, was on my other side. Her mindfulness practice was no surprise, as she always seemed serene. Their two daughters, Star and Makushla, practiced as I imagined veterans would. Ease and containment seemed to emanate from their breaths. As the five of us stood together, I began to understand the suggestion of being in the moment. Priscilla was 4 years old when I went to Roscommon to collect her. Down another small road, a man asked me what I had in the horse box. When he heard what my cargo was, he pleaded with me to take a young jack donkey that was a scourge to him, that it would be an ease to him. I thought it would be an ease to the grey gangly animal too, as he was spancelled with rope and a block of timber. When I brought the two of them home, a neighbour asked me what was Elvis, stating that if he was a jack, then all his apparel hadn't arrived from Roscommon. In time, his package arrived. And when he found his voice, he and Priscilla set about the language of the heart. Star was their firstborn, meeting the world from a field of buttercups as summer blazed the estuary in light taken from an Aegean ideal. 2 years later, Makushla gave the world her delicate presence. Both foals were brown like their mother, with none of the garishness of their Jack the Lad father. The day could be timed by their movements. They spent each night and early morning in the big meadow and gradually, lazily moved through the eastern ban, the orchard field, to Gurna Hill, where they stayed until nightfall. They were wonderful watchdogs, alert to each and every paw and footfall in their realm. Four sets of ears would point to a field corner, tracing a fox or evening badger. They would bray when the gate latch clicked. They would delight in human visitors, the three females attracted to brightly coloured clothes and carrots, Elvis trying to bite a hand or leg or pushing his weight against the fragile human. After their initial lesson in mindfulness practice, I sought their company for subsequent teachings. They taught me the importance of noticing the changes in the day and season, of seeking shelter or shade, and that gaining their trust for a human is something hard won but easily lost. They had their individual moments of practice each day, but I never found them in collective meditation as intense as that wonderful wet evening. Since that day, Elvis, sadly, has left the building. While Mukushla followed her father's spirit and is now buried on Gurna Hill, Priscilla had one more son, Flop, while Star had her own son, Flip. Today, Priscilla, Star, Flip, and Flop course the same route each day and night. They remain watchful for each movement and change, noticing, not judging, accepting, not reacting, except when humans impose change that usually is not necessary. They continue to teach if the lesson is sought, and continue doing with ease what can be so difficult to do. Breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, breathing out.
Thank you. It was 1989, the year Fair City was first broadcast on RTE, and I didn't know what I was doing in Limerick. I remember shivering in a phone box near the Crescent late one Tuesday night in a desolate quest to hear a voice from home and to shelter from the relentless horizontal rain. I hate it here, I told my friend on the other end, who sounded as distant as an echo. Only 100 miles from home, but home was Dublin, and this was Munster, and I might as well have been on another planet. Though I was warmly welcomed by my new employers and colleagues, who were constantly concerned that I was settling in well, and whom I constantly assured that I was, the truth is I was lonely and lost. I had moved from the security of a world I knew so well to a strange city where I didn't know a soul. In conversation, I often felt wrong-footed and stupid. Everything seemed different. The smell of the air, the feel of the rain, the nuances of unknown social rituals. In those early days, I was so far outside my comfort zone that each weekend, as soon as I could, I'd dash for the Friday train from Colbert to Houston. On Sunday nights, en route back to my good job with a heavy homesick heart and a bag full of freshly laundered clothes, I'd stand forlornly on that Siberian wasteland that was the platform at Limerick Junction, where it was always raining. I think of myself back then, me and my South County Dublin accent, fresh from UCD, knowing little or nothing of Ireland beyond the pale. How unfriendly I must have seemed, rushing back to the capital every chance I got. The idea of spending even a single Saturday in this place filling me with a special kind of lonely dread. Then one day, a kindly colleague offered me their spare ticket to a weekend rugby match in Limerick. My heart rose. Rugby. Finally, territory where I would feel comfortable and at home. The prospect of shared language and common ground filled me with hope. Needless to say, that maiden visit to Thomond Park in the late 80s was an extremely far, primal cry from the leafy suburbs of Lansdowne Road. Still, there was something about the rhythm and glory and the banter that made me feel I'd stumbled into the beating heart of Munster. So slowly, the pain of homesickness began to ease, and I woke up one day to find I wasn't feeling quite so lost, not quite so lonely. I would end up finding plenty of common ground with the people around me, and I would meet many soulmates, including the man who has now been my husband for 26 years. But before that, almost without my noticing, little by little, the magic of this part of the world had already begun to reveal itself to me. It might have been harder to see in 1989, but even then, Limerick City was a jewel of a place. I began to stay for more weekends after all and discovered many wonderful things. The Clare Glens in Maru with its fairy tale waterfall, the brilliant Bell Table, the gorgeous Granary Library, the Saturday Market, Gleason's, Flannery's, the Roundhouse, the Lock. And beyond that city, further west in County Clare, music and dancing in Ennis, fresh bread at Unglert's Bakery in Ennisdiamon, seafood and surfing at Lahinch, Liscannor and Doolin, barefoot beach walking at Spanish Point and Milltown Malbay, and the glorious glitter and foam of the wild Atlantic, different from but connected to the Irish Sea of my home coast. Of course, since then, my old and new homes have grown much closer together, and it's strange how I used to feel they were so far away. Dublin will always be my hometown, but Munster is home now too, a place where an unsure, lonely girl found her feet, was given her chance, and more than once was afforded the benefit of the doubt. How fragile my early commitment to this place had been, how close I once was to packing up and leaving for good. Like all transitions, I suppose it was 1,000 gradual things. But I do remember one definite moment. It was on my Sunday trek back to work, sometime in the spring of 1990. I hopped off the train at Limerick Junction, and as I walked across the platform, something unexpected occurred to me. There were no puddles. There was no rain. The clouds had parted, and the sun was beginning to shine. Thank you.
I was not used to seeing soldiers in real life, and I certainly wasn't used to having one stand in my train compartment with a very large gun over his shoulder and a look of suspicion in his narrowed eyes. Over and over, he looked at my passport photo and then back to my face. Neither seemed to please him. We had already established that he did not speak English, and I'm pretty sure I did not speak Czech. Yet somehow he had made it clear that he didn't think the passport I had shown him was mine. He seemed annoyed, impatient, and worst of all, confused. "Parlez-vous français?" I tried, which resulted in another narrowing of his eyes. Each time he did that, I became more conscious of the rifle in our midst. It was very big. And he was very young and clearly not used to tourists from the West, especially young, scruffy Irishmen with long hair, a beard, and a nose ring, traveling on a train from Munich to Prague. "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" my girlfriend asked helpfully, but his scowl told us this impasse was strictly between us two men. I decided I should point to the date the passport was issued, and then my date of birth, which would help him see that I was only 18 in that photo, young, fresh-faced, clean-shaven, while now I was a world-weary 21. And a lot can happen to a face in those 3 years. I stood up to do this, but he shouted and made an aggressive move that I quickly took to mean, "Sit down if you do not wish to be shot, foolish, hairy person." This was 1991, and the Iron Curtain had not long been opened. We Westerners had been brought up on a diet of blatant Cold War propaganda, so while on another border, the misunderstanding seemed one that could quickly be cleared up. Here, on a train stopped on the German-Czechoslovak border, I was actually quite terrified. The letters K, G, and B played heavily on my mind. And while he was busy looking from one of my faces to the other, I was looking from his young face to that massive gun on his back and praying that he wouldn't ask to see my ticket. We were traveling on Interrail tickets, and Interrail tickets bear the passenger's name. And for reasons that were entirely reasonable to me, my ticket said Neve Flood. Which is why I would really prefer if he didn't ask to see it. You see, I was living in Munich, and my girlfriend Alwyn and her friend Neve were the ones interrailing. And when they came to Munich, Neve stayed with some mutual friends and gave me her ticket so Alwyn and I could go and see Prague. We reasoned that no ticket inspectors in Bavaria or Bohemia would know Neve was a girl's name. And they assured me that some inspectors might ask to see your ticket, and others might ask for your passport, but nobody ever asked to see both at the same time. It was a foolproof plan. And yet here I now was, with a young soldier angrily looking from my passport to me, unable to see a resemblance. And if he did ask for my ticket too, unlikely to be impressed that not only did I have two faces, I also had two names. So then I tried, quite ridiculously, to mime the passage of time, time that saw young men growing beards. And that was when he blew his whistle. I heard footsteps and imagined handcuffs, a darkened cell and a trial straight out of Kafka. A second soldier entered the compartment, and this one seemed to be the boss. Now that a fresh pair of eyes was looking at the photo, I was sure he would, despite the beard and the hair, immediately see that it was me. "Hello," I was preparing to say. "How's the crack?" But no, he seemed as dubious as his colleague. He rooted in some pockets and took out pen and paper, and placing them on the little table in front of me, he made the gesture for a signature. And his young colleague nodded his appreciation of the plan. I, however, did not. In my 20th year, it had seemed important to have a cool signature. And after all, my surname, Harrington, is quite a long one. So I had worked on developing something that would be quick and short and indecipherable. A mere squiggle, if you like. But now, on this train, with not one but two large rifles in my presence, I couldn't for the life of me remember how I might have signed things at the time I got that damn passport. With all eyes in the crowded compartment on me, and possibly a sniper's crosshairs too, I made an educated guess that it was just my name scribbled quickly, so that is what I nervously attempted to reproduce. The boss snatched up the paper, and his acolyte held the passport beside it, and for a while it was touch and go, their faces giving nothing away. My heart was pounding, while deep in my pocket, Knee Flood's ticket felt as if it was on fire. Finally, the boss growled something. The passport was slapped down on the table and stamped, a little ungraciously, I thought. And they turned and left, banging the compartment door behind them. We sat in silence while our heartbeats slowly returned to normal. The train began moving, and finally Alwyn let out a sigh of relief and said, "See, I'm not the only one who hates the beard."
I had the good fortune to grow up overhead a newspaper shop in Milton Malbay. Long before it became famous for the Willie Clancy Week, It was home for me, and to this day gives me a sense of place. Before opinion polls existed, we knew a person's voting intentions by the newspapers they bought. Irish Press, solid Fianna Fáil. Irish Independent, certain Fine Gael. A Fianna Fáiler would never buy the Independent and vice versa. Sales of Cork Examiners depended on whether we had a blow-in guard or bank official. We sold two Irish Times, one to the Protestant minister and one to the resident lapsed Catholic. This man fell out with the fiery curate at Mass one Sunday morning. I was an altar boy at the time. The man had refused to come up from the back of the church. The curate insisted, he refused, and eventually left the church, swearing he'd never darken its doors again. The following day, he came in and placed an order with my mother for the Protestant paper. For years afterwards, he marched up the town with the Irish Times under his arm, the masthead clearly visible. I collected the Presses and the Heralds from the West Clare train every evening. I'd find them buried underneath exhaust pipes, Matterson's bacon, and day-old chicks. Sadly, some of the chicks didn't survive the trip from Limerick. Regularly, some of our papers didn't survive either. Some smart aleck in Innistime and our Corrafin got the free read, fair play to them. And they were good at removing the papers they wanted from the bundle too, because we never knew they were missing until we counted them. Every October, the Christmas annuals were delivered. Toppers, Beanos, Dandies, stacked up in the sitting room above the shop. I spent endless hours in the company of Desperate Dan, Corky the Cat, and the Bass Street Kids. I ignored Bunty and Girls Crystal. All that was sissy stuff as I saw it. The 64-page cowboy and war comics were firm favourites. Walter Mitty-like, I imagined myself as a rear gunner on a Spitfire pursued by the Luftwaffe. For years I repeated Achtung, Achtung, Donner und Blitzen, and Gott in Himmel in my childish games, having no idea what they meant. In my aunt's pub, the Blondes, my love for traditional music was born. The effortlessly natural music coming from the locals and visitors became part of my DNA. It was there on the Blondes' record player I first heard Bridie Gallagher's Boys from the County Armagh. To this day, whenever I hear the opening two signature piano notes, I immediately recognise the Kilfenora and remember Kitty Lennan. Christy Moore lived in Milltown for a few years and was a welcome visitor to our shop. Luke Kelly wandered in one morning and bought the copy of Eduardo de Bono's Lateral Thinking that had strayed in somehow and was languishing among the Mills and Boones and Zane Greys. We thought we'd never get rid of it. I recall Seamus Ennis nursing a mug of strong tea in the kitchen one morning when he was a bit the worse for wear. He had fingers as long as Clark's tin whistles, an essential asset for Illan Pipers, I later found out. Tommy Makem came in another time and bought a tin whistle. My mother didn't recognise him, and along with his change, she handed him the self-tutor manual, How to Play Down by the Sally Gardens. When she later found out who he was, unabashed, she said, he was as entitled to the manual as anyone else. You never know, he might even learn a new tune. Willie Clancy was a Sunday Press and a News of the World man. Some Sundays he wouldn't make it up to the shop because of a late session. His messenger would call in to us instead. Willie had left strict instructions with us, and that on those occasions we were to hold back the News of the World and just give out the Sunday Press. But one time, my brother forgot, and out of habit handed over Willie's usual order. The messenger was outraged. Back flew the News of the World across the counter with the words, You can keep your British filth to yourself. Thank you very much.
My uncle, Joseph Januarius Collins, born with one leg, one kidney, half a liver, and a dodgy ticker, was given one day to live in the 1930s. As a young boy, a hurley became his second leg, and Joe became goalie for the local team. He'd hop on his good leg and launch his body left or right to make a save. People travelled on bicycle back then, and he did too. His right foot strapped to the pedal, pumped up and down until he reached Scariff, 8 miles away. Uncle Joe never saw himself as disabled. That was only a sticker for his car window and used solely to gain close access to stadium gates. A polished walking stick was his third arm as he wildly gesticulated at the referee. It was unwise to stand behind him mid-chat. Joe left County Clare via Dublin and eventually settled in London in the 1960s. He worked as a financial controller for Moorfields Eye Hospital before he moved to Lloyds Bank. His future wife, Anne, was nursing in St. Thomas's Hospital in London. They met over the telephone wires and chatted for 4 years before they ever met in person. Anne and our beautiful cousin Catherine live in London today. During Joe's time at Moorfields, Sir Matt Busby was a patient. Joe visited him every day and they chatted about football, Irishness, London. The kindness was something that Sir Matt never forgot, as in later years, every year, he sent him 2 FA Cup final tickets, gold dust to a Man U supporter like Joe. By the time I was born in 1977, Uncle Joe had a prosthetic leg. It looked like the leg of an Action Man doll, a half-metal chair on top that he sat his left hip into and strapped around himself using 10 different buckles. "What happened to your leg?" my sister and I would ask. "I lost it after falling from a ladder," he'd say. Or, It fell off after I ate too many sweets. We did take such possibilities seriously, except for the time he told us it was shot off in the war. That tale seemed far-fetched to us, but we did wonder. At 60, he passed his driving test, bought a red Super Starlet automatic, the Red Devil, and took to the East Clare Hills like a boy racer in his first car. He was a great talker and was renamed Joe 90 due to that and his rising speedometer. He travelled to a match once in a car carrying 5 men. Joe suggested that they remove his leg to increase space in the back seat. The limb was unstrapped at the side of the road and travelled to Croker in the boot. I can imagine the looks the group received in Dublin as they attempted to strap the leg back on. Joe built a house on the shores of Loch Derg in the 80s, Grebe House, named for a favourite bird of his. His other was the elusive kingfisher. In summer, home from London, we often rode to a sandy inlet called Duggan's Bay. Joe would unstrap the leg and dive in. The cool water seemed a relief to his body, which must have strained greatly with the weight of his leg, but I never heard him complain, not once. I picture him strolling along the street outside our house, right hand on his stick, left leg swinging out from his hip on the beat, left hand in his pocket, jingling change, a habit that drove my mother mad. Thinking back, he must have had to hold the change in his hand to stop it clanging against his metal leg. Joe was raised up and carried out on the Radetzky March. My mother, clearly bemused at how the funeral attendees could be sitting down for such a rousing celebratory piece, ran to the altar and conducted everyone up and onto their feet. I like to think Joe marched out of the church with the rest of the congregation. The churchyard is called Clonrush and overlooks the bay. It's a hidden spot nestled in a copse of hazel trees. Joe's widow Anne tells me when she and my cousin Catherine talk, memories aren't memories to Catherine. She talks about people in real time, friends she would have met at home in Ireland with Joe. She talks as if those people are still there. She talks to Joe. Dada, she says, are you listening? And maybe he is listening. After a lifetime of chat, he's listening now. The greater crested grebe stands in shallow water, identified by 2 long legs. And the kingfisher? Well, that's the fastest bird on Loch Derg.
When summer time has gone and autumn winds are threatening to blow our love away, it's then love will be tested. Arm in arm we'll stand, side by side together, to face the common foe that will tear our love asunder. Tooralooralay, tooralooraladdy, tooralooralay. Where are you now? I need you. Gone like the autumn sun on a dark December morning. When hard times come around, like cold and stormy weather, it's only you shelter one another. Tooraloo-ralay, tooraloo-ralandy, tooraloo-ralay, tooraloo-ralay. Now if there's a time to fight, and there's a time for healing, when the sun will melt the snow on a clear, bright April morning, our fight has run its course. Now let us start a healing, and let us both embrace sweet reconciliation. Tooraloo-ralay, tooraloo-ralandy, tooraloo-ralay,
That was Sunday Miscellany live in Ennis. Readings and music from special programmes last year and the year before, recorded in Glore as part of the Ennis Book Club Festival. The scripts were Mindfulness by Maurice Crowe, The Sun Shines at Limerick Junction by Sarah Moore Fitzgerald. Then we had Incident on the German-Czech Border by Noel Harrington. Growing Up in Milltown was by John Hurley. And Joe 90 was by Dee Collins. The music was Anuman by Django Reinhardt and Coleman Hawkins, played by Boris Hunka on piano and Diane Daly on violin. The Limerick Lasses, A Reel, played by Blackie O'Connell on the Illan Pipes and Cyril O'Donoghue on bouzouki. Ticket to Ride was played by the Ennis Brass Band, conducted by Mark Nutley. Willie Clancy's Gold Ring Jig was also played by Blackie O'Connell on pipes, Cyril O'Donoghue on bouzouki and Siobhan Peoples on fiddle. And then Reconciliation by Ron Kavanagh, sung by Katie Theasby with Ger O'Donnell. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.